He gave me a father. We'd go play baseball, and he'd take Dumb Denny and I to play baseball, and we'd ask him for a soda, and sometimes we'd go down and get a pop, as we call it, where I grew up. We'd get a pop at the diner outside. It was a streetcar diner outside the mill. And there were, you know, when the men were in the mill, they weren't out there, so it would be empty, and we'd go and we'd sit at the bar where the men sat, and I'd have a orange pop, and Denny would have a grape, and Dad would have a root beer, and they were 6 cents a piece. And there were days when we'd go there, and Dad would say, "I'm not very thirsty. Why don't you guys have it? I'll just take a drink of yours." And I know now that those were days he only had 12 cents. And then there were days when he'd say, "You know, Mom looked lonely when we left. Why don't we go back? She probably has some iced tea or some Kool-Aid or something. Let's go back and spend time with Mom." And that's when he didn't have 12 cents. And I opted to see poverty instead of a man who loved that much. Just loved with everything he had. And so I always opted to see those things. And that's what I had done to God my Father. Everything he'd ever presented to me, self-will and selfishness and self-centeredness, had warped it to a point that I destroyed it. I killed it. And I had to come to you to learn how to think differently. And the third step is the way I did it. You continue to confront me and confront my old ideas. I'll give you one. There was I had an idea that once you found out what the problem was, that you had to immediately find a solution. And if you didn't, you'd have to drink. I really thought that Alcoholics Anonymous is about solving problems. My problems, not your problems. The hell with your problems. My problems. And I'd start running around. I'd drive people crazy. I'd start running around. And, you know, you go to old-timers, they speak in parables. They never answer your question. It's the strangest thing. And I remember one time I went to this old-timer, and there was a problem. I think it was August of 73, a terrible month, August. And I went to this old-timer, and he said to me, "You know, Keith, I don't know the answer to that." And he said, "But there's a guy down at the Metropolis Club who knows, and his name's Amos." And so I went down in the Metropolis Club, and I asked for Amos. And Amos was out on the 12-step call. I said, "Well, I got to talk to him." I'm thinking, I got about 45 minutes to live. And because I got to, you know. And he said, "Amos will be back shortly because there's going to be a meeting." And so I waited, and Amos came in. He had a drunk with him. And so I ran up to him. I said, "I got to talk to you." He said, "Well, son," he said, "I'll talk to you right after the meeting." I said, "I got to talk to you now." He said, "Look, sit next to me." He said, "No one sitting next to me ever died." And I said, "All right." So I sat next to him. And when the meeting was over, he's a wonderful man, a kind, kind next to me. He said, "No one sitting next to me ever died." And I said, "All right." So I sat next to him. And when the meeting was over, he's a wonderful man, a kind, kind man, a black man with his kind, kind eyes. And I said to him, I told him what my problem was. And he said, "I don't know the answer to that." And I said, "Oh, no." And I said, "I thought you could help me." He said, "Well, I don't know the answer to that." He said, "But I have a suggestion." I said, "Well, anything." And he said, "Don't drink, even if your ass falls off." I remember driving home thinking, that's the most profound thing I ever heard in my life. And I came to understand something about Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not about solving problems. Alcoholics Anonymous is about finding solution. There's a solution for living. It doesn't matter what the problems are. The problems disappear because of the solution, not because we figure out the problem. And, you know, unfortunately, I go to meetings in a lot of places. And what happens? Somebody will say, "Anybody here have a problem?" You ever hear those? You know, somebody says, "My mother had a square nipple." You know, and we 50 untrained psychiatrists spend an hour dissecting this problem. You know, and it's not about problems. It's about solutions. And it's not about sharing feelings. You know. It's about, so I remember I went to a meeting. I'd been in a treatment center, and they never told me that AA was sharing feelings, but that's what I learned. I mean, that was the impression I got. So I go trotting off to a meeting, and I want to belong. I mean, I really want to belong, because if I don't belong, I'm a dead man. I knew that, you know. And I didn't know how to belong other than to act the way I thought you wanted me to act and say the things I thought you wanted me to say, and then you'd like me enough to let me stay around. And that's the way I live my life. Not proud of it, it's just the way it was. And so I got to this problem, and it came to this meeting, and it came to me, and I shared my feelings. And a great hush fell over the crowd, and they looked at me for a moment, then they went on, and I went back the next week, and a man met me at the door, and he said, "Hi, how are you?" He said, "You have a good week?" I said, "Yes, sir, I did." He said, "You know, after you left last week," he said, "we had a business meeting." And he said, "The vote was 12 to nothing. Nobody gives a damn how you feel." He said, "If you don't like the way you feel, wait 5 minutes. You'll feel different." I said, "You know, that's true. That's true." Because I was like this, you know. And he said, "We're interested in what you do." He said, "Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of action." He said, "We want you to take certain actions, which we took. And if you'll take these actions that we took, you'll get what we got." And he said, "And then the day will come when you won't care how you feel." And I'm thinking, I can't imagine that. But you know, it has. There's a good friend of AA. He's not himself an alcoholic, but I spent a lot of time with this man, and he's a wonderful man. He's a Jesuit and a priest and a PhD in psychology and all that stuff. And his name's John Powell. And I asked John at the International in 1980 in New Orleans. I spent some time with him, and I said, "John, you know, I was sober about 7 years, six, seven, 8 years, tough time, and I was tired of it." You know what I mean? I mean, I was trying to work a spiritual program. It was like holding my breath, you know? I mean, I had all these things going on and all these character defects running wild, and I'm trying to control them, and I'm just losing ground quickly. And I said to him, I said, "John, what's this crap all about, this spiritual life? What's it all about? You know, I've been acting spiritual. I mean, that's what you do. You act spiritual, you know?" And he said, "You know, Keith," he said, "you're in a perfect place to do this." He said, "Maturing," he said, "with a spiritual life is just a matter of maturity." And he said, "The first thing that everybody must do is to discover who they are." And I said, "And who they aren't?" He said, "That's right, who they aren't." And he said, "The second thing is to fully accept who we are." He said, "And the third thing is to forget who you are." And I thought, man, that's right. You know, I'd known spiritual people or religious people who had a spiritual experience, a spiritual awakening. I have nothing against that. Believe me, I've had them. But they have like a boom, like a top of the mountain experience. And then they'd run around inflicting that experience on everybody else. Well, the problem was they hadn't gone through the process. They didn't know who they were. You know, they meant well, but they didn't know they were being obnoxious. You know, they hadn't accepted who they were, and they hadn't forgotten who they were. Self was stuck all over that. And then I look at old-timers and Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're laid back, and they're easy, and they say rough things to us, and they say it in a way that we're not offended. We even laugh. You know, and that's where their way of telling us they love us. You know? And you know, we do stuff to them too. We have a guy in town, he's a wonderful guy, but he's supposed to be, you know, seeing impaired, right? So he feels his way to the meetings and all this stuff. Well, he gets on the kids a lot, you know, he's rough on the kids, and so they always exact revenge. You gotta watch young people, they can't be trusted, you know. I think, you know, a certain time they ran out of souls, and they kept making bodies, and we got some of them in AA, they're young people with no souls. And so what they did to this guy, he's a great old guy, just love him. What they did to him, though, was he can't see, right? Well, they put a dime under the chair in front of him. And he comes in, and he's feeling his way in and all. He sits down, and he looks, and he sees that dime, and he reaches down and picks it up, and they all laugh and point at him and everything, you know. Mean kids. But the third step is this process where I come to accept that most of what I know is wrong. I've misinterpreted all these principles that I've grown up with. I mean, I love what Sandy B said. The receiver was broken. I heard all the right stuff. And I tell you, how many times in Alcoholics Anonymous I've heard, "I was taught a God that does this." I used to do that stuff. I was religiously anti-religious. I really was. I mean, I was waiting to be offended, you know. I was going to whip out the Constitution on some people in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. They talk about God, and I was ready to jump all over them and everything. Well, of course, the book says we don't apologize for God. Of course we don't apologize for God. It says that we're reborn, and we are reborn. And I think what that means is that my old ideas become changed. And the third step is simply the process where I begin to accept the fact that my old ideas are going to be changed, and that I come more and more to rely upon being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, rely upon this process where I put myself in a position to hear the antithesis to what I believe to be true. And I swear that all the things I swore I'd take to the grave with me, I no longer believe are true. And I can't remember when it changed. It just did. It changed because I was hanging on to it. That's why it changed. It changed because I defined it and said, this is where I stand. I'll tell you, the guys I sponsor who say, I'm not doing this, and they lay it all out, tell me all the stuff they're not going to do. I say, yeah, fine. You know, and then they go and do it. But the people who won't define it and remain vague about who they are and what they are and what they believe and all the rest of it, those are the people who never change. You know, I love a guy who fights me. Even if he's doing it inside, you can just see it. Who died made him king, you know. And I love that because they're taking a position, and that's what the third step's about. The third step's all about taking a position, because then I can change. But if I don't take a position, I'll never change. Okay. And then we go to the fourth step, and I just wanted to briefly mention, and we'll kick tomorrow off with the fourth step. I wanted to briefly mention that if anybody wants to do any work or wants to spend any time talking or anything, I'd be awful happy to sit down with you, okay? They gave me a nice room up there, and then they gave me an adjoining room with a table and a couple of chairs. So if anybody wants to sit down and talk or do some work, or you want to get started on a fourth step or this, I'd be awful happy to sit down and help you. And there are a number of ways to do the fourth step, and this is heresy, but I could not figure out how they did it in the big book. I couldn't figure it out. Now, next week I'll be down in Florida talking with Joe and Charlie. And if I had met them, maybe I could have figured it out. But I couldn't figure it out. It made no sense to me. It just made no sense to me. Okay? And here I am running around for 3 years in Alcoholics Anonymous not doing a fourth step because when I tried it, it made no sense to me. And I had a man who knew enough about me and knew enough about Alcoholics Anonymous, and a man who was sober longer than me and agreed to be my sponsor. And he saw me unable to do this. And it wasn't because I didn't want to, I just didn't understand it. My mind just wouldn't work in those boxes and those columns. So he took a yellow pad and he wrote fear. And he skipped two pages. And he wrote anger, and in parentheses he put resentments. And he skipped two pages and he wrote sex and left the rest of the yellow pad. I was a guy who had run around looking for the right pencil or the right pen. Because if I had the right pen and the right notebook, I'd write the fourth step. If I had the right pen, I had the wrong notebook. Right? And so finally he told me, he said, look, he said, I'm going to let you on a secret. He said, now, don't share this with anybody. Just a few of us know this in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, it's impossible to lie with a yellow pad and a number two pencil. He said, now, don't spread that around. You know, so he gave me a yellow pad and two number two pencils. And he said, now, at night, sit down and ask God to direct your thinking. And he said, right. And he said, I want you to list the things you're afraid of. I said, I'm not afraid of anything. And he said, well, he said, it seems to me one time you told me you're afraid of dogs. I said, well, big dogs. I'm afraid of big dogs. So he said, all right, write down big dogs. So I wrote down big dogs. And I thought for a minute, I said, you know, Sandy, I'm not wild about little dogs. He said, well, write down little dogs. So I wrote little dogs. And then we began, and fear of heights, fear of failure, fear of success, on and on. And what I discovered when I listed my fears, what I discovered was I had a tremendous number of fears and conflict. And you think about it. I'm a guy who was afraid of being alone, and I was afraid of intimacy. Boy, that'll have you jumping in and out of relationships, won't it? It's no wonder my wife would say, who showed up? You know, who showed up? I mean, one day I couldn't live without her. The next day I was rejecting everything about her. You know, I was a guy who was afraid of success and afraid of failure. Think about that one. What I'd do is I'd find a job and I'd go like crazy and I'd become real successful. And then I'd blow it. Because, you know, you get successful, they're going to expect more out of you. You know how they are. And I began to understand. I mean, it began to dawn on me why I was insane. I mean, I had these constant fears. And I had them on both ends of the spectrum. And I lived in constant turmoil and constant conflict. You know, I was sober not very long. And Dan was still my sponsor. And Dan told me to, I came to grips with an old idea. Dan told me to, he said, I want to see you at the Foxhall group. He said, there are a couple men speaking that I want you to hear. And I said, I don't go to that group. And he said, why don't you go to that group? I said, they're a bunch of snobs. And he said, you ever been there? I said, no. She said, well, I heard they're a bunch of snobs. She said, well, you don't even know them, Keith. He said, they're a bunch of alcoholics. She said, I want you to go. I said, I'm not going, Dan. I'm not going to do it. And he said, we had an agreement. If I did what he said, he wouldn't break my knee. You know, that was our agreement. He made it up. And he said to me, I want you to go. I said, I'm not going. He said, I'll break your knee. I said, I'm still not going. And he said, why aren't you going to go? I said, they don't even use styrofoam cups. I said, they have their own cups. And he said, well, he said, you know, they decided they didn't want a bunch of styrofoam. He said, what difference does it make you what? He said, they wash them. You don't wash them. And I said, yeah, I said, you know that they have a bunch of, you know, like little finger food and stuffed mushroom caps and stuff. And he said, well, he said, you know, Keith, he said, you know, it's a social event and a lot of people are retired and they enjoy that and they come there and they, he said, what do you care? He said, just be there. And so I did what any normal alcoholic would do. I found the rattiest clothes I could wear, fine, and I took my own styrofoam cup, and I went to the meeting, and I was going through the line, and there was a man there named Philip Harmon, and Philip was a professor of romantic poetry at Georgetown University. He's an odd duck. He had a handlebar mustache, and he had handlebar eyebrows. I never saw anything like him. And he was a longtime member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and later became a great friend of mine. And he was back there with all the finger food and stuff, and I got my styrofoam cup, and I got these really ratty clothes on. I mean, I never would have worn anything like this, you know. And I'm going through the line, and Roland said, how do you like our meeting? And I said, the Swedish meatballs suck. And my sponsor hit me in the back of the head. He said, get through the line. And so I was just a wreck, you know what I mean? I was just a wreck. I sat there, I couldn't think, and everything else. And so he said, we got to talk. So after the meeting, we went out and we sat on a stone bench. I'll never forget it. And he said, what's the matter with you? And I started to cry, and I said, I hate these people. And he said, what do you mean you hate these people? He said, they're alcoholics. I said, they're rich people. I hate them. And then he asked me a very interesting question. He said, do you want to be poor the rest of your life? I said, of course I don't want to be poor the rest of my life. He said, you know, you will have to be if you don't change your old ideas. I said, what do you mean? He said, somewhere along the line, you got the impression that people who were successful or accumulated anything were bad. And I thought about it, and you know, my parents never said that. They never said that, but we really were poor. And the implication that poor people, the implication of poverty is you're somehow spiritually superior. You're better than them because they got what they got, ill-gotten gains, by stepping on your neck. Now, nobody said that to me, but that's what I grew up with. That's what I brought out of poverty. And Dan said, you've worked hard all your life. I said, I went to work when I was 12 years old. He said, why don't you have anything? I said, well, that woman divorced me. He said, no, it's not her. He said, she doesn't have anything either. And she does, she didn't get it from you. And he said, why is it that you would begin to accumulate something and then you would blow it on a stupid purchase or a dumb investment? And I knew why. I remember as a little kid, my father was invited to every Christmas. It was the worst thing that happened to my dad all year. Every Christmas, the man who owned a factory that he worked in would invite us to their house. You know? And every Christmas, it was the same thing. My father, we'd get dressed, and my father would set us down, and he'd say, now we're going to go to Mr. So-and-so's house. For God's sake, don't touch anything. He has lamps that cost more than our house. So we'd go out there, and he'd say, and he was a great guy, and he'd say, would you like to play? No, thank you, sir. And he'd say, and I remember looking over saying, don't touch that lamp. If you touch that lamp and you break it, they're going to take our house. And this is, as a child, this is what I learned about people who were successful. And I came to grips with it in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Dan said to me, if you don't change that idea, you're doomed to be a failure the rest of your life. He said, you'll be a great starter and a poor finisher. And that's just an example of the kinds of things that fear do to us. I mean, Bill says that the fabric of our lives is shot through with fear, and that is absolutely true. Now, we come in, we have the obvious fears, and some fears come and go. I have a terrible fear of flying, you know. And they always say, well, it's hard to fly if you have a fear of flying. No, it's hard to get on the plane. Once they close the door, it's out of your hands. And I just don't like to fly, and I fly, you know, 30-some weekends a year or something like that, you know. So we can do things with fear. Now, being brave is not the solution for fear. You know, being brave, you never, you know, that's no solution. Being brave, you know, you can hold your breath and get through things. The solution for fear is trying to grow in faith. I get on a plane because I really believe that's what God would have me do. And that's it. And you know, I found out not long ago that I'm really not afraid of flying. I'm afraid of crashing, you know. And you get that all figured out. You know, that makes sense. And so as long as you aren't crashing, everything's okay. And some those fears come and go. There are times when I just am terrified, and then there are times when I don't even think about it. But they come and go, and I accept that. I accept that. But the fears that root me to my past, you know, the fears that dictate the terms of my life, the fears that are so subtle that it has me behaving in ways I don't even understand. For example, I used to get angry with my wife if she was sick. Now, that's crazy. I mean, I would get angry with her, and I would be cross with her if she was sick. And suddenly, when I'm doing my inventory, I came to realize that I was afraid of losing people. I was always afraid of losing people. I was afraid of being broke. And I realized that, you know, my father used to say, we go to the poorhouse. We're going to go to the poorhouse. And I had no idea where it was, but I didn't want to go there. It's like the wayside. I mean, nobody wants to go to the wayside. I've never been to the wayside. But nobody wants to go there because everybody says, don't fall by the wayside, you know. And don't go to the poorhouse. I mean, there are certain places you just don't want to go. And I began to understand that fears drive me. Fears drive me. And then I listed the things at which I was angry. And I found out that the majority of the anger that I carry around, the majority of it, comes from the fact that I'm fearful. My reaction to fear is anger. You know, I found out that I would always end up with women that I didn't want to be with. Anybody know? I don't mean they were tough. You know what I mean? I mean, they were tough and they were competitive, you know. And they would like to beat you around the head and shoulders with hammer-like blows. I mean, you know, it was just always this constant, you know, conflict and head-banging and all this stuff. And I couldn't figure out why I always ended up. And in my inventory, I began to understand. I was so afraid of women that I would always come across as a very angry man. And the only women who could put up with me were the ones who liked angry men. And they weren't the ones I wanted to be with. And so I always ended up dating people I didn't want to be with. Well, once I began to understand that, and I could actually say to someone, you know, I may appear angry, what I really am is frightened. And I could then be around people I wanted to be around. And that's why I'm married to the woman. I'm married to the kindest, most gentle human being I've ever met in my life. My wife and I have known each other 15 years. We've been married over 10 years. And we've had two arguments. The second one happened, we were married a month. And we began to disagree, and I began to raise my voice. I mean, I don't raise it much, but just, and I stopped, and I said, I love you more than anybody in the world, and I'm going to raise my voice. There's something wrong here. And I remember the axiom in a 10-step, and it was a problem with me. And I said, there's a problem with me. I'm going to go call my sponsor. And she said, you know, there's a problem with me, too. I'm going to go call my Al-Anon sponsor. And we called our sponsors. And that's how we deal with our problems. We don't deal with our problems. We don't get together and talk it out. You know what getting together and talking it out means? You know what it means? It means I want another opportunity to change your mind. That's all it means, you know. But if I approach it that if I'm at unrest or if I'm unhappy or if I'm conflicted, then the problem's with me. It's not what you do. The problem's with me. And these are the things I began to learn as I listed the things that I was angry with. Okay? And then I spent time with sex. And I'll tell you, I don't understand sex. I mean, I understand a little bit about the mechanics, you know. But I was so messed up about what I believed, what I didn't believe, what I was guilty about, what I wasn't guilty about, all the rest of it. My sponsor said, you start at your earliest recollection, and you write everything you can think of. And I'll tell you, this sounds silly, but I remember when I was like 3 years old, my sister... 2 years older than me. You know, it's worse. You'd rather have the plague than an older sister. I'm telling you, older sisters are the meanest people in the world. They do stuff to you. It's awful. Just awful. Like, she used to say to my mother, Mother, I'll take Keith to the movies with us. And my mother would say, you're such a good girl. And I'd get all excited. You know, what a dummy. I'd get all excited. And then she'd take me down to the bus stop, and her girlfriends would come. And they'd say, what's the idiot doing is he going to come with us? And I had big ears stuck out. I looked like a taxi cab with the back doors open. I was skinny, big ears that stuck out. She'd say, no, he's going to flap his ears and fly down, or he'll meet us down here. And pretty soon I'd end up crying and running home, and my mother would say, what's the matter with you? You ungrateful little kid, as nice as your sister is. Older sisters are terrible. And she put a dress on me. She said, you're going to be a little girl today. And I was 3 years old, I did it. You know, I never forgot that. Here I'm 30 years old, and I know that secretly I'm probably a transvestite, and I just refuse to face it. Insane, isn't it? I mean, it's insane. But it's insane because it's in there. Once I wrote it down, I said, I haven't worn a dress in 27 years. I'm probably not a transvestite, you know. I don't even want to wear a dress, you know. I'm probably all right. But I mean, you know, I mean, it sounds crazy, but in there, it holds great power. So I wrote down everything that I could think of. Now, I'm going to talk more about the fourth step tomorrow. But the reason I wanted to get into it a little bit tonight is if there's anybody here who wants to start an inventory process, and if you're really having a hard time understanding how this works, you know, so that's how my sponsor had me started, okay? Now, I've taken a number of them. Okay? And I have taken them the way the book says, once I finally got it, my head around what it meant. But he had me do this, and then he had me answer the questions in a 12 and 12. How and in what way did my selfish pursuit of sex damage others? Who was hurt? Da, 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 da. He said, write down the questions and write down the answers. And that's the way I did it. And it served me very well until, you know, it kept me sober long enough to do it the way it said it in the fourth step. So I just wanted to sort of throw that out as a suggestion. Are there any thoughts or questions or anything? I'm doing all the talking and you guys are doing all the listening. Any questions about any of this? Comments? Pardon? I'm delighted to be here. I really am. Thank you very much. I am really pleased to be here. This is a very special place, isn't it? You know, any place that a couple of alcoholics get together is special. You know, my brother, Dub Denny, made an interesting observation. He said to me one time, he said, I had asked him some years ago to come to play my member guest golf tournament while I was living in Fayetteville. And he had just begun playing golf, and he said, okay, he'd come. And he came, and we're best buddies. I just can't tell you. I mean, we're so close. We're, because of the ninth step, and I'll share that with you tomorrow. Because of the ninth step, we're the way we were when we were kids. You know, he played shortstop, and I played second base, and we turned double plays, and we were best buddies, and we confided, I like her, and I like her, and, you know, all that stuff. It was wonderful. And then because of my self-centeredness and my self-absorption, I lost that. And as a result of the ninth step, eighth and ninth step, I got it back. And he and I are just dear friends, just dear, dear friends. And he gave me an insight. He had come down to play my member guest, and he came a week early. And it was an AA golf tournament over in Pinehurst. And so I said, would you like to play? He said, yeah. And he had individually met friends of mine in AA, but he had never met a group of you together. And so we went over and we played the golf tournament, and it was a two-day tournament, and then we practiced all week, and then we played my tournament. And then I called him up the next year. I said, can you come for the member guest? He said, I'd love to. He said, the AA tournament too? And I said, well, I don't know if there's one or not. I'll check. He said, you know, that's the best time I ever had. And I said, really? And he said, you don't know what you have. He said, we met two guys on the first tee. And he said, you'd never met him before. He said, by the fourth hole, you're cursing each other. He said, you assume a love and a friendship that I don't presume with people I've known for 20 years. He said, alcoholics are special people. He said, members of Alcoholics Anonymous have capacities that nobody else has. And you know, it's true. It's true. I can know you 5 minutes and I can know everything I need to know about you. And I not only know, I care about you. And I know, even more important than me caring about you, is I know you care about me. Yeah, thanks a lot. Good morning.
Good morning.
Everybody have a good night? Well, I slept like a rock. I'd like to moan and whine this morning, but I just can't. I just slept really well. I heard our hostess was whining to Brother Andre this morning about something. I don't know what it was. making bad signs at me. I don't think that's very spiritual, but... In a murder trial, the defense attorney was cross-examining a pathologist. Here's what happened. Attorney, before you signed his death certificate, had you taken the pulse? Coroner, no. Attorney, did you listen to the heart? Coroner, no. Attorney, did you check for breathing? Coroner, no. Attorney, so when you signed his death certificate, you weren't sure the man was dead, were you? Coroner, well, let me put it this way. The man's brain was sitting in a jar on my desk, but I guess it's possible he could have been out there practicing law somewhere. You know, we were talking about, that's for Ray O'Kay, if anybody runs into him. We're out there practicing. We're out there, or last night we were talking about the fourth step when we broke up, and I'd like to get back to that a little bit if I could. And I had said it, that there's basically a simple way that my sponsor led me into this, and it concerns me that people get so dogmatic that everything has to be done a certain way. And we actually have a member of my group who doesn't like to read the 12 and 12 because I don't know whether it's heretical or what it is. And you know, it's easy for us to forget that what we do here is share our experience, strength, and hope. The man who took me through the steps loved the 12 steps and 12 traditions. So basically, that's what we always refer to as the 12 and 12. I read the big book. I read it every day. I mean, so, again, I don't want to sound like Martin Luther nailing up a bunch of theses or something like that, but I just think there's a lot of ways to approach this deal. And I always ultimately go back to doing it the way the big book says. I just want to make sure I cover all my bases. But Sandy had me do the thing I talked about with the fear and the anger and my sex life. And then he had me answer the questions, write down the questions and answer the questions in the fifth chapter, step four of the 12 and 12. And it begins on page 50, and it says, when and how and in just what instance did my selfish pursuit of the sex relation damage other people and me? What people were hurt and how badly? And of course, and did I spoil my marriage and injure my children? Did I jeopardize my standing in a community? Just how did I react to these situations at the time? Did I burn with a guilt that nothing could extinguish? Or did I insist that I was the pursued and not the pursuer, and thus absolve myself? How have I reacted to frustration in sexual matters? And it goes on and on. Then it goes on and talks about our financial situations and that sort of thing. And I found that to be particularly useful. And whenever I am working with a guy who's having a very hard time, even if I get him the outline out of the big book and he's having a very hard time, I usually have him do this. And I particularly have them, if people are emotionally very upset and sort of strung out, I have them do it this way, and then with the idea always of going back and doing it again. The other thing my sponsor had me do, which I found to be very, very useful, he had me do some work with the seven deadly sins, you know, and they talk about them in the 12 and 12. And what he had me do is he gave me a little pocket notebook. And I buy them now by the gross and give them to guys that I work with. And he instructed me to take one deadly sin at a time. And, of course, in the book it says pride heads the list. So I wrote down pride. And he said, now find a definition of pride that makes sense to you. So I began looking in dictionaries and talking to people and all kinds of things. And I put together a definition of pride that made sense to me. And he said, now I want you to, during the course of the day, as things occur, I want you to look at how pride enters into your life. He said, it's critical to see how the seven deadly sins or character defects enter into our lives on a daily basis. And it's amazing what pride will do. You know, I find myself being irritated if the stoplight stops me. And it lets the guy ahead of me go, and then stops me. It's like there's a little man waiting. Here he comes. Boom, we'll get him. Oh, look at him. Look at him. He's mad. Yeah, we'll get him. Phone the next stoplight. They'll get him, too. No, it has nothing to do with the fact that I burn rubber away from the previous stoplight and I'm going 70 miles an hour in a 35. It's got nothing to do with that. It's got to do with the fact that they're waiting for me. I always get in the wrong line at the bank. I don't know if anybody else does this. And then I stand in that line and I'm watching the other line move faster. And I always get in a line with somebody who's hiding one of those bags full of change, you know, that sort of thing. And I think I ought to be treated differently than that. And, you know, during the course of the day, I'd stop whenever this would happen. Impatience is one of the signals for me of pride. Whenever it would happen, I'd stop. How do I want to be treated differently? And I'd jot it down. And, you know, by the end of the day, it's amazing how pride enters into our life. This whole concept of poor self-image. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you hear a lot about poor self-image. And you hear a lot about the need to be affirmed. I don't mean to be politically incorrect, but I have a friend. I said to him, how's it going up in Washington? And he said, well, he said, all the guys are suffering from pride. He said, all the women are suffering from poor self-image, you know. So that's a popular one. But this whole business of poor self-image is an amazing phenomenon. And this need to be affirmed. You know, it's my wife... when I was drinking, my wife was going to a psychologist, which I was sure explained why I was drinking, and because she had emotional problems, and he asked to see me, and I thought, you know, here we go. She's told him all these stories, exaggerated stories about my drinking and my behavior and stuff, but I really loved her. I really wanted it to work, and I really wanted what was best for her as much as I could, so I went to see this psychologist. So he talked to me, and she was sitting there, and he asked me some questions, and then finally he asked me the biggie. He said, your wife says you drink a lot. I said, that's true, I drink a lot. And he said, how much do you drink? And I said, about a half a fifth a day. Now, it was really about a fifth a day, but I never counted it if I didn't have to pay for it. You know, it's like... like my liver was saying, here comes a free one. You know, don't pay any attention to it. And, you know, I mean, we have these ways of keeping count. And so he thought, he nodded his head. And he said, and I asked him that question, it just fearful. It just dragged it out of myself. And I said, do you think I'm an alcoholic? Because my wife had some very strong opinions on this, you know. And he said, no, certainly not. He said, you're too young. And he said, you're too intelligent. And he said, but if you keep drinking like that, you will be an alcoholic. And I said, well, when? You know, I thought it was important. You know, I wanted to quit in time, you know what I mean? I mean, you didn't want to, you know, drink to be an alcoholic. You'd be crazy to do that. And he got a little put out with me. He said, I don't know. He said, a couple years. So right away, I formed this plan. I'm going to quit in a year and a half, and I'll be all right. And if you're new and you're thinking like that, you're already there. I hate to tell you this. But then he went on to say, he said, your problem is that you have a very bad self-image. And then he turned to my wife and he said, and part of the problem is yours. And I'm thinking, I don't know what we're paying this guy, but he's worth every dime. And and then he went on to explain that I needed to be affirmed. And he'd actually done his doctoral thesis on affirmations. And so, as we were talking about computers and things, well, this is when they had that Selectronic typewriter. Remember, IBM made that. You could make the different size fonts and things like that. And he took my own personal history, and he gave me my own personal affirmations. There were two full pages of, and it says Keith's affirmations. I still have them someplace. And so he told me, he said, now every morning I want you to get up, and I want you to go to the mirror first thing. And I want you to tell yourself these things. And he said to my wife, he said, and I want you to stand with him if you can, because if you're there while he's affirming himself, it'll be further affirmation for him. And I'm thinking, and maybe we'll undo some of the damage he's done to me. And so I was so, well, you can understand, I was just delighted to find out I wasn't an alcoholic, so I got very drunk that night. And evidently, I said some of those things I was wanted to say when I was drunk. And the next morning, I was affirming myself all alone. You can bet on that. And I never forget, I stood in front of that mirror, you know, and I looked at those yellow bloodshot eyes, and I had my list of Keith's affirmations. And the very first one was, Keith, today you're a winner. You know? Today you're a wonderful husband, no matter what she thinks, you know. And today you're a loving father and a good researcher, and on and on. I got about halfway through that list, and I said, today you're full of crap. That's what you are. You know, you know, I may have been an alcoholic, but I wasn't insane. I mean, I knew this wasn't true. I knew this wasn't true. And the reason I like to think about that story, and I like to tell that story, is because that's the way I treated what was wrong with me my whole life. I tried to pile good things, good acts, affirmation, pats on the back, job well done, that a boys. I tried to pile all those on this rotten structure that was my life. And of course, what Alcoholics Anonymous tells me is that I have to go in and I have to tear out the structure and have to start all over. And it really cautions me, you know. In the big book, it says it's a foundation firm. You know, have you put too much sand in the mortar? And on. I mean, they ask very, very, very important questions. So I can't be fixed from the top down. I have to be repaired from the bottom up. And that's the fourth step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why it's critical to have turned your own life over to the care of God before this process begins. Because once I made that decision, my will and my life was no longer my business. I call my sponsor up and be whining about something. He'd say, well, that's none of your business. It's God's business. You made a decision to turn your will and life over to the care of God, and you stay out of it. You're the guy who screwed it up in the first place. And he said, what if I gave you a car? I said, that'd be a good idea. He said, no. He said, this is hypothetical. What if I gave you a car, and then every couple of months I called you up and said, have you had it tuned up? Have you changed the oil? You know, did you rotate the tires? He said, you'd say to me, look, you give me the car or you didn't. If you want it, come and take it back. And he said, so don't question these things. Just do the work. Just do the work. And he said, disassociate yourself from how you feel about it. Just do the work. Critically important information for me. And so I began to tear it out. Bill Wilson's concept, what a brilliant man. His concept of character defects are interesting. They aren't what happened to me. You know, they aren't the fact that mother had a square nipple or I was put on a potty chair backwards and I've been confused ever since. I didn't know which end was up or anything like that. His concept was, what's wrong with me is that my normal instincts, normal God-given instincts, have become warped. That's an ugly word, warped, but it's his word. And that as a result of that, my behavior is abnormal. I want more of everything than is due me. That I become selfish and self-centered. I asked my sponsor one time, somebody accused me, it's hard to believe, but somebody accused me of being self-centered. And I was really insulted. And so I went to my sponsor, and I said, tell me about this self-centeredness stuff. And he said, well, he said, supposing that we could unscrew the top of your head. And he said, in your brain were a bunch of little index cards. And every question you would ever ask is on those index cards. He said, the question we'd run into most often is, hey, how about me? Does anybody know I'm here? You know, I like in a line this morning, I'm looking to see that there's enough bacon for me to, you know, when I get there. You know, and there's more bacon there than we can all eat, but I got to make sure that there's enough there for me. Hey, how about me? Has anybody got mine? You know? And I said to my sponsor, I said, well, that's because I'm from a big family. He said, no, it's because you're self-centered. You know? Can't be that simple. It's got to be something deep and Freudian. And so that's what I had to do. When I'm doing a fourth step, I had to see how my normal instincts for sex, society, and security overran themselves. And how I always needed more than everybody else. I give an example. One of the problems with the people I've worked for over the years, I've worked for men and women over the years who meant well. The problem was they never understood their job description. You know, they thought their job was to supervise me or to tell me what to do. They didn't know their job was to affirm me and make me feel good about myself. Yeah, I mean, I had a drill sergeant in the Marine Corps, or a platoon sergeant in the Marine Corps, who really thought his job was to tell me where to go and what to do. He didn't know his job was to make Kesey feel good about himself and to affirm me. And so I'd always end up angry with authority because authority never understood what their responsibility was to me. I could never get enough of it. We won the baseball championship, and I could feel good for 5 minutes. Then I'd have to begin looking for the next stroke or the next pat on the back or any of the rest of it. And in a way, Alcoholics Anonymous, it was perfect for a place like me, because in the beginning, they'd pat me on the back and say, "Oh, you brushed your teeth today? You're doing very well. You didn't drink today? We're really proud of you." And on and on. And then, of course, that wears off, and they start expecting you to do things like, you know, grow up. You know, stuff like that. It's really none of their business. I think it's important for us to remember that what's critical to this whole process is that we dig out that stuff. We see the areas of our lives that are abnormal, particularly the areas where I'm making demands on people, places, and things that I have absolutely no right to demand. And of course, the solution for this stuff is to, one, recognize it, and then we have 6 and 7, which is we share it with God, ourselves, and another human being. Then we go to 6 and 7, which is the place that we begin to unload and to dump some of these things, okay? And we let God take them out of our lives. So that's basically the fourth step. Now again, I've done it a variety of ways. They've all worked. How do I know they've worked? I'm sober. Okay, I'm sober. I'm sober a long time. One of the things I bump into also is, I was talking to a guy Thursday, a guy I sponsor, and he said to me, I think I need to go back, and he's had a traumatic time, been through some difficult times, and he said, you know, of his own making, of course, those are the best kind, because it means at least we start out enjoying it. And if somebody else is making, we may hate it all the way through, but boy, if it's our making, you know, well, at least I was in love for 3 days. So he said, I think I better go back and start at step one. And I said, I don't need to go back and start at step one. I said, you know you're an alcoholic, you know you're powerless over, you know your life's unmanaged, you've done all that stuff. I said, who's the next person on your 8th step list? Well, that's where the problem is, isn't it? It's always easy to go back and do it again. I remember I was sober about 12 or 13 years when I sponsored to be my sponsor. And I'd been through a couple years of extreme self-centeredness and how about me? And so I said to him, well, where would you like me to begin, Tom, with an inventory? He said, no, he said, I never like guys who want to do inventories do inventories. He said, that means that either you don't need it or you're too good at it. He said, what I want you to do is go find a new guy. And of course, that's what I needed to do. I was self-absorbed and self-centered again. So I was saying, hey, how about me? My friend Mike Way always says, enough about me. What do you think of my tie? And that's the way I was living my life. And of course, what I wanted to do was become more self-centered by looking at me again and figuring out what's wrong with me. And of course, what was wrong with me was I was thinking about me. And what I needed to do was think about a new guy. So I went to a meeting that night, and a new guy wandered in, you know, looking around, you know. And I said to him, I said, is this your first meeting? He said, yes, it is. I said, my name's Keith. I said, let me explain how we do things here. I said, here, we assign ourselves as sponsors, so I'm your sponsor. And it was 3 months before he realized I couldn't do that, and by then it was too late. He was used to me. But I immediately went out and found somebody. I mean, that's what you do. And so I'm saying this because it is important to do this work, but I see people get stuck in this because somehow they believe that this makes them feel better. Stirring this up and living here all the time makes me feel better. Living here all the time is narcissistic. You know, if I had a warehouse full of goods, and they always use that example, and if I go into inventory the warehouse, okay, and then I write down everything that's there, and I go back the next day and do it again, and go back the next day and do it again, somebody might say to me,
don't you think you might should be doing something else? You know what's there. Maybe you ought to be doing something else with your life. And again, I love treatment centers. My life was saved in a treatment center. But I came out of that treatment center with a concept that getting sober was a matter of inventorying and sharing my feelings and sharing this and sharing that. Now, that's important. But all that does is get us well enough to live life. And I always worry about people who live there. Okay? Now, I do the spot check daily inventory, and when we get to the 10th step, we'll talk about that. I do my 10-step inventory. I mean, I do that. I look at my life. I don't let my life run unobserved. I believe Socrates was right when he said that the unexamined life isn't worth living. But I don't think that Socrates meant we walk around staring at our navels all day and asking ourselves that profound question, how does that make me feel? You know, I mean, how I feel is none of my business. It's, you know, my will and life's been turned over to the care of God. So I want to say this because this isn't the biggest deal in the world. The fourth step is not the biggest deal in the world. It's simply doing what I know. It's not doing what I don't know. And this thought of, if I don't do it exactly right, a big hand will come down and put a drink in my mouth. I've seen people get drunk, and the book says we get drunk if we don't do the step. It doesn't say we get drunk if we don't do it perfectly the first time. So I think there's too much emphasis put on this in a lot of people's lives because it's fearful. And, you know, just do it. Just do it. And one way to do it is to set a date to do the fifth step. You know, we don't like to fail, so we'll be ready. You know, we'll be ready. We'll do as well as we can do. And the fifth step, of course, is I think one of the reasons that four is fearful is because the fifth step is there. You know, and the fifth step is admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrong. Now, I'm going to tell you what happened to me. I had taken a fifth step, or a couple fifth steps, I guess, and fourth and fifth steps, and then I sort of took the fourth step. You know, somewhere along the line, you take the fourth step. Clarence Snyder used to say, you take the first nine steps one time. Well, everybody used to freak out, you know. And he said, but, he'd smile and say, you take at them for years. And I think that's true. I think we take at the inventory steps for years. And then one day, they're done. You know, one day, it happens. And I took the fourth and fifth step. Now, I've done inventory work ever since. I mean, at least twice a year, my friend Mike W. and I, we've done this for 25 years, we do our semi-annual house cleaning. We both get our yellow pads and we write and we get together and we talk. And we keep each other current, but we do that. So I do that, but my the fourth and fifth step that was the one I took, and I took my fifth step. My sponsor wouldn't let me take it with him. And I said, why? And he said, I'll tell you later. And the later, the reason was that he knew that what he thought of me was too important to me. I really wanted to please him. I've always wanted to please those in authority. And I really wanted to please him. And he was afraid I would be less than forthright with him. And it would be a lot easier for me to be honest, truly honest with somebody else. And so he arranged for me to take it with a man named Ed C. And I went, and Ed gave me specific instructions, and I'm really glad he told me to do this. He said, I want you to do precisely what the step says. And I said, yeah, I'm going to share with you, God, and another human being. He said, no, he said, I want you to do exactly what the step says. Admit it to God. He said, is there any place that you experience God? And I said, well, yeah, there is. He said, I want you to go there and take your fifth step with God. I thought he's out of his mind, you know. But I went back to that chapel that I had begged God to save my little girl's life in. And I sat down with my fifth step, and I told God exactly who I was. And it was an amazing experience for me, because I left there knowing that God loved me. And the fear I had about God and everything was largely gone. And then I went home, because he told me. Now, when I went to see God, I put on a three-piece suit. You know, I hadn't been there in a while. And I reminded him I was the one who would serve 5:45 Mass when it was snowing and nobody else wanted to do it. I mean, you got to grease the skids a little bit. But then I said to God, I said, Father, as far as I know, this is who I am. And I read him my fourth step. And then I went home, and I sat in front of a mirror. You know, the full-length mirror, the kind you practice your golf swing in front of. My wife thinks it's for other things, but she doesn't know it's to practice your golf swing. And I told myself exactly who I was. An amazing thing happened to me. I always thought I was afraid of other people. It turns out I'm not. I was afraid of God and of me knowing the whole truth. And then I went to find Ed, and it wasn't a problem at all. And I told Ed everything. Told him everything. And he listened. And he was one of those guys who does it so well. He's heard thousands of fifth steps. And he just knows the questions to ask and the things to say to put you at ease and that sort of thing. And it was very, very easy. As a matter of fact, he was down at the ocean, down in Ocean City, Maryland. And I chased him down there and made him hear it that night. I was ready. I wanted to get this thing over with. I wanted to get on with my life. You know, I'd lived in that prison too long. And he was kind enough to sit up till about 2 in the morning to hear this thing. And I found out later that he had chased some woman down there, so he was really sacrificing for me. But then he sent me out on the boardwalk at 2 o'clock in the morning with the big book to look at, to make those considerations of step 6 and pray that 7-step prayer. I'd like to, if I could, I'd like to say something about hearing fifth steps. I think that truly the most humbling act that I, as a recovering alcoholic, ever gets to do is to hear someone's fifth step. That a human being would allow me there still overwhelms me. And I hear a lot of them in prisons and everywhere. We have a room in our house. We made it a little chapel, I hear fifth steps in there. But the fact that a human being would honor me with that just amazes me. And I always come away just overwhelmed, just absolutely overwhelmed with the grace involved in being invited into a place that maybe no other human being had ever been invited before. And it's funny, I don't remember what people tell me. It's the strangest thing. I just don't remember what people tell me. It's like it passes, you know, in my ear and out the other ear or something like that. And because it's not important that I know. What's important is that I listen. I always usually tell guys after I hear their fifth steps that tell them a story. When I was blessed with a scholarship, I was sober. I think that's worth talking about pushing God's will. But I was sober 4 months, and I had this thing. I had to finish my education. I don't know where it came from, but it became an obsession with me. Now, when I was drunk, I wasn't real worried about it. But now that I'm sober 4 months, so I went and signed up for 3 courses. Now, I didn't have any money, so I wrote the university I worked for a bad check and signed up for 3 courses, and I knew that they would forgive me, and we'd get it straightened out somehow. It was 2 philosophy courses and a theology course, and they were my majors. And so I went home, and I bought the books, and I went home, and I opened the book, and I began to read. And I don't know if anybody had this experience, but I knew all the words, but no thoughts. And I'd read a page, and I'd say, what did that page say? All I can remember is it said page 1. That's all I can remember. And I couldn't remember a thought on the page, and I panicked, and I called my sponsor. And he said, you did what? He said, you get your ass over. That was always how we began our discussions. So I went over, and he said, look, he said, you're not ready to go to school. He said, you have to talk to me about these things. He said, your brain is all messed up. It was just, you know, it was like about a month before this, I called him one morning. I was on my way to work, and I couldn't remember where I worked. True story, I could not remember. I'm in a car, I'm dressed up, this is a true story, I couldn't remember where I worked. And he had given me a card, you know, and had taped a dime on it, and he said, if you're ever in trouble, call me. He used to tell me often, second most important thing in my life is your sobriety. He said, it's second only to mine. And so I called him, and I didn't want him to think that he's sponsoring a guy who couldn't remember where he worked, because I secretly believed that my real problem was I was insane, and I mean that was a secret, and that I drank because I was insane. I really believed that. So I call him and I said, good morning, Dan, how are you? He said, I'm fine, how are you? I said, fine, I just wondering how you were. And he said, what's all that noise? And I said, I'm calling you from a phone booth. And he said, your car break down? I said, no, car's fine. I was just wondering how you are. And finally he said, what's the problem, buddy? And I said, well, it's not much of a problem, Dan. I just can't seem to remember where I work. And he always said the same thing. He said, oh, you can't remember where you work. And I said, a lot of us have had that problem. I've never met anybody else who had that problem. But he said, and he talked to me about, you know, the book says that to pour alcohol on our brain is a very unnatural thing. And you know, we went through all that routine and everything. And then, like a month later, I'm signing up for 2 philosophy courses and a theology course, you know. And he reminded me, you know, last month you didn't know where you worked, kid. You know? Yeah, I keep bringing that stuff up, you know. He's like you can't make a mistake. And but he told me that day, I called him, he said, can I make a suggestion? I said, anything, I'm honest, willing, and open-minded. You know, after you made a fool of yourself, you get that way. And he said, if you ever have this problem again, he said, I'd like to suggest that you try to remember to look at the front bumper of your car. He said, you have a parking permit for the university. And I remember thinking, where do these people learn these things? I mean, you know, they make life look so easy. How do they do this? And, but at any rate, so he reminded me that, you know, a month or so before that, I couldn't remember where I worked and why was I signing up for courses and why did I write a bad check to the university for whom I worked and everything. He said something to me that's critically important. He said, God gives you everything you need when you need it. And he said, don't push it. He said, every mistake you make will be because you push it. So I had to go back. I had to go to the registrar, apologize for the bad check. It hadn't bounced back yet, so she stopped it so that they didn't charge me money. They were very good to me and everything, and I dropped it. And he said, keep the books. And I said, why? He said, just keep the books. He said, you ought to have a reminder on your bookshelf of what happens when you do it your way. And so I did that. Well, you know, 1 year later, I had to go see the chairman of the department. And, you know, whenever the chairman of the department wants to see us for one thing, it's to fire you. We know that. I mean, because people in authority don't want to talk to you unless it's to fire you or to torment you. And he didn't understand his job was to affirm me. And and they always want to see you Monday morning, and they tell you Friday afternoon. So you get the whole weekend to think about it. You know? So Monday morning I go, and I'm a wreck. And and he said to me, he said, Keith, he said, we're so proud of what you've done this last year and a half. And he said, I can't give you a raise. I can't, because it was a wage and price freeze in effect then. And he said, but I can give you this. And he gave me a letter. It was a full scholarship. As long as I wanted to go to school, I could go to medical school, could have done anything I wanted to do, fully paid. And all I had to do was continue to work for him. He said, because we'd do anything to keep you here. I was just amazed. And I went down to my office, and my boss was there. He's a professor there and a Jesuit priest, a research geneticist, a wonderful man, brilliant man. And he said, did Paul give you the letter? I said, yeah. I said, I'm overwhelmed. And he said, well, he said, they give me credits for books every year. And he said, you know, a book lasts me 15 years. He said, so I've got all these credits. So he said, here. And the only books I paid for to get my education were the books I paid for when I did it out of self-will. I never bought another book at that bookstore. They were all free. And I went in the office and sat down, so I wouldn't fall down. And I got a call from a woman who was at the Veterans Administration's office at the university. And she said, you were a veteran, weren't you? And I said, yes, I was. And she said, well, you have education benefits. I said, they've lapsed. I said, they ran out. And she said, well, today the president's signing a bill to extend the benefits for you Vietnam-era veterans. She said, so I figured it out, and if you can carry 12 hours a semester, you can make $300 a month. And I was $150 a month in the hole, and I just was overwhelmed. All that within an hour, first hour of getting to work. And I called my sponsor and said, we better have lunch. You know? And I discovered that it's a lot harder to accept what God delivers to me than I thought it was. I always thought I wanted good stuff, and I discovered just how very difficult it is to get good stuff, and how left to my own devices I'll ruin good stuff, because on some level I'm not yet ready, or I'm not supposed to get good stuff. So I really like to remember that, okay? I really like to remember that when I'm talking about the fifth step, that that pushing God's will has always been a problem for me. And that's all part of the amends process. One of the things I learned, and when I went back and took a degree in philosophy and theology, and one of the things I learned, there's a theologian at the university who had written a book, and it was on the seven sacraments, and her name is Monica Helwig, or is Monica Helwig, and she talked about the sacrament that Ed Dowling, Father Ed, referred to as related to the fifth step of Alcoholics Anonymous, this business of where we tell another human being, God and another human being. And it talked about how at one time the business of being excommunicated from the community was a big deal. I mean, you know, there was a time when people never went more than 10 or 20 miles from their home, and they absolutely needed to rely on one another. It was imperative that they rely on one another. And so to be excommunicated was to die. No one would speak to you, no one would give you anything to eat, no one would feed you, no one would take you in, and you'd just die. So being part of the community, being part of the world, was very, very important. And then pretty soon a guy comes by on a horse, and he says, we're going to go fight something called the Crusades. And all the young men got sharp sticks or whatever they did, and they got behind a guy on a horse, and they go off. And they spent 20 years doing things they never could have believed they could ever do. Just horrible things. And just doing the next thing, like I did as an alcoholic. They ended up doing horrible things, and, you know, murder and plunder and rape and pillage and things like that. And then 20 years later, they go back home, and the town turns out, and their boys are home, and they're cheering them and telling them how wonderful they are and everything. But they know they know the real story. They know who they really are. And so they go to the priest and confess, and the priest tells them they're forgiven. And they say, but we don't feel forgiven. We feel outside of the community, you know. If they knew. And of course God's forgiven them. Of course God's always faithful to forgive if we ask him. But they felt foreign. And so the priest said, well, ask the community for their forgiveness. So they would put on sackcloth, which was the international sign of mourning, and they would put ashes on their head, and they would kneel outside the cathedral on Sunday when people were going into Mass, and they would say, please pray for us. And I think that the people probably got tired of tripping over them. And they said, look, stop this. We'd have done the same thing if we'd have been in the same situation. We're human beings just like you. We've never been tried that way. That's the only reason we haven't done those things. And I tell the guys that I hear their fifth step, I tell them that story. I like to hug them and welcome them back into the community of man. Because I'd have done what you did if I'd have been in the same situation. And that to me is a crowning moment of those 3 or 4 or 5 hours or whatever it is. The crowning glory. That I have the opportunity to invite someone who felt as alienated and as outside of life as I had been back. With all as the military used to say, all the rights thereunto pertaining. And that's what we have. We have full rights as human beings. We come back. And that's the magic of the fifth step. And everybody remembers the great promise of the fifth step, of course. On page 75, it talks about the fifth step. And I think this is, you always hear people read the promises, the eighth or the ninth step promises, the ones on page 83 and 84 at meetings. I really wonder about it. I mean, I think it's fine. I love those. I mean, if you got my original big book and you dropped it, it opened to page 83 and 84. And it has smudge prints on there because I come running home from work or wherever I was, and I'd be trembling. I'd say, how's it going to be? Let me see. Are you going to know a new freedom and a new happiness? So believe me, I really like those. But the implication, or at least what a lot of newcomers come away believing, is this is what happens if you go to meetings. And what happens if you go to meetings? What happens if you go to meetings is we use more coffee. Okay? This is a result of doing the steps. The promises are a result of doing the work, not going to meetings. I went to a meeting this past week It was a lunchtime meeting over in Wrightsville Beach, nice group, kitchen group, and the topic was, do I go to enough meetings? Now, I'm not a guy who's against meetings. I went to, first 2 years I was sober, I went to 500 meetings a year. I went to them in other countries. You know, I went to them in languages I didn't even speak, which seemed appropriate because I drank in bars where they spoke languages I didn't speak. But I mean, so I had always gone to a lot of meetings. But meetings aren't the cure-all. You know, meetings is just, that's just one, it's an important part, but it's just one part of the program of recovery. It's working the steps. It's doing these things that change me, that change me. Painful as they may appear to be, okay? And so I concern that we stress those promises so much without explaining that they begin to happen when we begin to get right with the world, okay? But I like these promises. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs. Now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on a broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. Boy, if that isn't something for a guy who was so isolated that he didn't even believe he was around. You know, what an amazing twist of events. And I remember that sense. And you know, people always talk about what they feel or don't feel or this or that, relief or whatever it was. It's amazing to me. What I felt was nothing. And it had been a long time since I felt nothing. I felt empty and at peace. And it had been a long time since I felt empty and at peace. But most of all, and it just amazes me to this day, most of all, I felt as though I belonged. Felt as though I was a real, honest-to-goodness human being, doing the best he could do with what he had. And that, to me, is the freedom. You know, I want to briefly run through what it says in the book here, okay, and then go back and talk at some length about 6 and 7. It says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything. I always ask at the end of the 5th step, is there anything that you haven't told me that you think about? Well, and it's always something that's minor. Like when I was 3 years old, my sister put a dress on me. And since then, I'm afraid that I am destined to dance someplace in a dress. And but it's not a big thing. I hardly think about it at all. Something like that, you know. And I have to tell you this. This isn't very delicate, and I apologize beforehand. But I sponsored a guy one time who couldn't talk. Now, he had the capacity to talk. He just couldn't make words come out. And he would, and his eyes would bulge, you know, and he looked like a fish is what he looked like. And so if the phone rang and nobody said anything and there was no heavy breathing, I assumed it was him. So I just talked to him, you know, and then I put the phone down, do something, go back, talk some more. And finally I'd say, well, I got to run now, Bobby, goodbye. And he'd say, bah, that would be it. That would be our conversation. And so he finally began to be able to talk to me a little bit. And he said to me, would you hear my 5th step? And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to have to take a week's vacation. So I invited him. This was, I lived up in Maryland. I invited him over to my house, you know. So I figure I'm going to put him at ease. Now, here's a very serious, very anxious, nervous guy. And I figure, man, I got to put this guy at ease, you know. So I said, Bobby, I said, you know, a lot of times it's useful to go to the sex stuff first, because that's what we're often most ashamed of. And I said, so why don't we do that first, and then we'll go back to the other. And I find the sex stuff, though we're most ashamed, is probably the least important. You know, it's harder to uncover the selfishness, self-centeredness in other areas of our lives. I said, so let's get to that. I said, so why don't we start off with a part about the goat and the midget? You know, I'm trying to be funny. And he looked at me and he said, how'd you know about the goat and the midget? And I thought, oh my God, I just put my head in my hands and I looked at him. He had a big smile on his face. He said, I got you. Carefully reading the first five proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything, for we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? Okay. Questions we ask ourselves. Again, this isn't perfection. You know, I work with guys who are hard on themselves because they can't remember what they can't remember. I said, think about that. I said, I just want to know what you can remember. I said, if we want to know what you can't remember, we'll go to Madam Mitchell down the street and have her look into a crystal ball, and she can tell you what you can't remember. Oh, you're only responsible for what you can remember. And when those memory bubbles come, remember those? Oh, I'd be walking down the street and mind my own business, and I'd remember it. I go, oh. Oh, how could I have done that? What was I thinking? You know, I was thinking about the next drink. That's what I think. And so I called my sponsor, called Ed, and said, yes, I just remembered one. He said, well, good. I like to hear it. I like yours. And but often you'll be sitting in a meeting and somebody will tell an experience and remember it. It pops there, you know. And said, if we can answer to our satisfaction, we look at step six. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. We are now ready to let God remove from us all the things which have been, we have admitted are objectionable. Can we now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. Now, you know, in the one of the reasons I like the 12 and 12, in addition to the big book, is that Bill had a longer, and other people in the fellowship had a longer view of this process. My sponsor used to say that, you know, Bill was sober 15 years when he wrote the 12 and 12. People say he wrote it alone. I had lunch. I started a little thing in Wilmington, and we call it Old Gas Excretion Group. And the old parts is what we call it, and we meet for dinner once a month, and we do it because I love being around the old timers, and Lib S moved to Wilmington and lives with us, and Lib just celebrated 54 years, and Lib worked in New York when Bill was writing this, and she said that he never did anything alone. She said he would write a page and he would come in and they'd all have to sit around the office, and they would discuss it, and he'd make notes, and they'd say, yeah, that's right, or that's wrong, or we don't agree, or we do agree, and this and that. So he didn't write it alone. He wrote it in collaboration with other alcoholics. But Sandy used to say to me, you know, he was sober 15 years. If he didn't learn anything in 12 years, then he's wasting his time. And so what they are additional insights into the process, and that's one of the reasons I really like the 12 and 12, because he had additional insights into the process. In a big book, it's pretty cut and dry. You know, you take the book down from the shelf, you go away for an hour, you look at the proposals, have I given it, all this stuff. The 12 and 12, he said, this is a step that separates the men from the boys. I mean, you could just hear the desperation. And I think that what the steps, the sixth step effectively does is it really does begin this process of separating the men from the boys, the girls from the women. Okay, it really does, because it shows us how difficult it is to change. I love one thing that Father Joe M. talks about is, he said, if you think change is easy, he said, if you're used to carrying your wallet in your left pocket, try carrying it in your right pocket. You'll invariably put it in your left pocket and go, oh, that's right, and move it to your right pocket. And that's what I do with character defects. Oh, that's right, I'm not supposed to do that. I better put it back, you know.